From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
Hello from South Berkeley, below Ashby.
I live in North Richmond.
Kentfield.
Oh, I live in San Jose, near Campbell.
Bayview.
Coming up, we'll find out what closing San Francisco's public parks at night could mean for those who sleep there.
I sleep in a park. I live where the cops don't come after dark.
Then, from the San Quentin Prison Report, we'll meet a man who says self-help groups inside of prison helped him turn his life around.
It was unusual for me to see another man offer you something and not expect nothing in return.
And we'll hear about a chance meeting that reconfirmed one woman's faith in the power of a helping hand.
Never think that people aren't listening. And never think that you're not making a difference.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. Tomorrow, San Francisco supervisors will consider legislation to close the city's parks overnight. If passed, no one will be allowed in parks run by the city's recreation department between midnight and 5 a.m. There are a few exceptions, including Golden Gate Park, where people will be allowed to drive or walk on paved roads and sidewalks. But they're only allowed to cross through. They have to keep on moving. People who violate the proposed law could face fines of up to $1,000 and/or 6 months in county jail. Advocates say the law will help stop vandalism and illegal dumping, but critics are concerned about its effects on homeless people. KALW's Mary Willis reports on the controversial proposal.
It's 5 p.m. on a weekday. Cold weather has set in, and joggers, cyclists, and dog walkers are bundled up, making their way around Golden Gate Park. I see a sign that says the park is closed between midnight and 5 a.m., except for through traffic. But now, a new law could make it easier to enforce when people can and cannot be here.
My name's John Miller. I actually live in the Panhandle. And I think generally it's a great idea. In my opinion, I think the majority of the people that are out at that time are the people that are not doing your typical activities.
My name is Michael Dolan. I live on Broderick Street, right near the Panhandle here, and I'd be in favor of the closure.
And why would that be?
To prevent overnight camping, I think, would be a good idea.
He's talking about people like Tripp, a man who lives in the park near Haight Street. Tripp says he won't move out.
Yeah, I'll stay on tape. I don't give a f***.
What's your name?
My name is Tripp. How y'all doing?
And Tripp, what do you think about this idea?
The idea don't matter because I sleep in the park. I live where the cops don't come after dark. I love sleeping in the park. I'm going to be sleeping here till it rains and I'm leaving.
A few blocks away at Buena Vista Park, I don't see any signs about when it's open or closed. But under the proposed law, that would change. A group of people I meet there is concerned. They sleep in this park and they're worried that they'll get pushed out and onto the concrete sidewalks.
My name's Andrew. Everybody calls me Nacho out here.
And what will you do if the parks are closed down between midnight and 5?
Have to deal with the streets and the doorways, and then we get tickets every day and get arrests and all that kind of shit. Here, we aren't bugging nobody.
This legislation is not about homeless people sleeping in parks. It is already illegal in San Francisco to sleep or camp in a park.
Scott Weiner is the supervisor who proposed this legislation. He says what the law would do is allow the city to be tougher on vandalism, something he says is hard to do right now. San Francisco is the only major city in the US that doesn't have citywide closing hours for all its parks. And Weiner says when vandalism happens in the middle of the night, unless vandals are caught red-handed, there's nothing that can really be done about it.
So having a preventative measure by being able to say to people, the park is closed, you know, you need to step outside of the park, is going to be one more tool for the police and for the park patrol to use to prevent vandalism before it happens.
How is this going to be policed? And is there enough funding to be able to, and resources to be able to make that happen?
We are understaffed in our police department, although we're changing that. We finally started having police academy classes again, so within 3 or 4 years we'll be at full staffing. So we need more police officers, we need more park patrol. That shortage is not an argument against passing a law.
But Jennifer Friedenbach, Executive Director of the Coalition on Homelessness, has a different argument against passing the law.
It just gives them an excuse. It gives them the political will. It gives them the cover to say, all right, time to crack down. Let's get all these homeless people out of the parks.
Friedenbach doesn't think the legislation will make a difference to vandalism, and she fears that the police will have new orders to sweep out the approximately 300 people who currently sleep in city parks.
These kinds of initiatives have been tried over and over again, and they fail because there's simply nowhere for people to go.
The San Francisco Board of Supervisors are scheduled to consider the new legislation tomorrow. For Cross Currents, I'm Mary Willis.
Opponents of the law are planning a sleep-in protest tonight at 9 p.m. in Dolores Park. What do you think about the proposed closures? Are you ever in the park between midnight and 5 a.m.? You can let us know by calling 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Now we'll bring you another story from the San Quentin Prison Report, KALW's collaboration with inmates making radio from inside of California's oldest prison.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
SQPR is a media collective of prisoners and volunteers from the community working together to give voice to personal growth, social transformation, and restorative justice.
SQPR.
Our mission is to create documentaries, films, and audio programs that broaden and challenge the conversation around crime, punishment, and rehabilitation in the United States.
James Houston says that when he was imprisoned in 1996, he was an angry, self-centered, rebellious man who felt he had no purpose in life. He knew that if he ever hoped to be released on parole, he would have to completely transform himself. 17 years have gone by since then, and a lot has changed for Houston. He credits those changes to his participation in self-help programs within San Quentin. From SQPR, Tommy Shakur Ross has our story. Oh, and the Media Lab in San Quentin used to be a laundry facility, so sometimes the rusty pipes make noises that you're going to hear. Here's Tommy.
Opponents would argue that rehabilitation through self-help groups are a waste of time. Criminals will never change. Well, convicted felon James Houston says he is proof that demonstrates the opposite. His story starts in 1996 in Richmond, California. He was 21 years old, and he says he was a very different man back then.
When I committed my crime, all I saw was me and my victim. I didn't realize that I had damaged not only, you know, his life, but also his family, you know, had an effect on the community. So that was like a real eye-opener for me.
Houston was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to 18 years of life. He says it was a dark time, and it took a while to come to terms with what he had done. It really hit home for him when he had a visit from his young son.
My son was 3 years old, and I hadn't been in his life since he was 10 months. And so the see him at the end of the visit with all my family members crying because he wanted to stay with me kind of had broke me down after that visit, and I really realized that how selfish I had been.
There was no way to know when he would be let out, but Houston knew he would have to start changing his ways if he were ever to rehabilitate himself. Then, when he arrived at San Quentin in 2005, Houston really began to work on his personal growth and development thanks to the self-help programs available here.
I would say the first self-help group was really education. That's what I wanted to come to San Quentin for. Heard about the AA degree program here. I achieved my AA degree in 2010.
The AA degree program he's referring to is the Prison University Project, Patton University at San Quentin. But beyond his education, Houston was also motivated to seek self-help by the kindness he received from other prisoners.
It was unusual for me to see another man offer you something and not expect nothing in return.
Today, Houston is 39 years old. He's soft-spoken, clear-eyed, and well-groomed. Replace the prison clothes he's wearing with a suit and tie, and in his No More Tears group, he will resemble a facilitator.
It made me more accountable. You know, I could no longer hide behind a veil of ignorance. You know, I knew then,
you're responsible for what you know.
Or in the addict recovery counseling program, perhaps he'd resemble a certified alcohol and drug addiction counselor.
We do one-on-one case management. We have small breakout groups where the men get to dialogue with each other.
Then again, as part of the Richmond Project, he looks more like a mentor and community activist.
Because I remember being as a kid, looking out my window, seeing guys selling drugs, doing violence out there. And I looked up to them and I emulated them. And so I want to let them know that, you know, that type of lifestyle isn't cool. It's been a good way to give back and reach out to our community, because with a life sentence, I never knew if I would get out. And so I had to do what I could for them.
The truth is, James Houston is all of these things: scholar, counselor, mentor, community activist, and more. Because his latest focus has been on building a business through the self-help program called The Last Mile.
The Last Mile is about teaching us entrepreneur skills. You know, many of us, we have a lot of talent, and most of us just use it in the wrong direction. So we've been reading books, had a guy Kawasaki come in, John Hamm, MC Hammer. We had a lot of people come in and support the program.
As a participant, Houston was afforded an opportunity to share his business plan on what's called Demo Day here at the prison. James Houston was successful in this endeavor. From prison, he created a nonprofit called Teen Tech Hub.
Yes, it's for at-risk youth ages 9 to 14, focused on leadership, life skills, as well as advanced technological training. A guy from Richmond, Eric Moore, a venture capitalist, who had wanted to create a similar program himself. And so we connected and found out I was getting out soon and started a partnership there and started. He's out there doing the groundwork now.
But the biggest test for Houston came in February 2011, when he had his first appearance before the Board of Parole hearings. It had been 15 years since he was incarcerated, and he was able to show the board that in that time, he had become a different man. Soon after, he was notified that he was found suitable.
Being found suitable means that I've done the work and I'm no longer, in their eyes, to be a threat to society. And so what it's basically saying is, what I always hear is like the board members saying, I wouldn't have a problem with you living next door to me. If it wasn't for the self-help groups and the changes I made, then there's no way I would have been found suitable.
On May 29, 2013, James Houston did get paroled. Perhaps he now lives next door to you. Reporting for the San Quentin Prison Report, I'm Tommy Shakur Ross. I'm out.
Houston now has a job in San Francisco, and he's living in Oakland. He's working on getting his startup going, and we'll plan to check in with him when he does and give you an update. The San Quentin Prison Report is a partnership with KALW to bring stories from inside of California's oldest prison to the public radio airwaves.
The San Quentin Prison Report is produced by founding director Troy Williams and managing director Nigel Poole. The SQPR production team includes reporters Tommy Shakur Ross, Shawala Stepter, Greg Eskridge, and production assistant Shireen Garcia. SQPR is made possible by the support of Warden Kevin Chappelle, Public Information Officer Lieutenant Sam Robinson, TV Specialist Larry Schneider, and KALW News Director Holly Kernan.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Our next story comes to us from Hear Here, KALW's ongoing community storytelling project in Oakland and San Francisco. Last year, our Hear Here producers set up shop in the Golden Gate branch of the Oakland Public Library to talk to local residents about their work. They heard this story from Regina Tolbert.
It's just really good to go to work every day and at the end of the day feel like you've done something to help women. My name is Regina Talbert. I'm a physician assistant at Highland Hospital and a backup medical provider in women's health in the Santa Rita Jail. When I started working at Highland, it was 1991, and in the early 90s, we were seeing a lot of women who were being shot, basically, possibly because they were in girl gangs or they were the girlfriends of guys who were in gangs. There was one woman who was pregnant. She was about 28 weeks pregnant. She was shot in the head, and she was in a coma. She stayed in the intensive care unit through the time that the baby was delivered. The baby was delivered by cesarean section while she was still in a coma. She eventually came out of the coma, was in the hospital for months and months, finally learned how to walk, and left the hospital. Well, years later, while I was working at Santa Rita Jail, there was a young woman who I saw in the clinic. She had a weakness on one side, so I asked her, you know, what was going on with, you know, one side of her body being weaker. And she told the story about being shot, being pregnant, and being at Highland Hospital and having the baby delivered while she was still in a coma. It was amazing. That was the woman. It was the same young lady. She reflected on how it was a miracle that she survived, and it was a miracle that her baby survived. And she also mentioned that she knew that everybody worked hard for her and her baby. She had plans to get out of jail, never go back again, and just be thankful of all of the good fortune that she had and turn her life around. That story just made me realize that never think that people aren't listening, and never think that you're not making a difference. Because sometimes it's going to come back to you in different ways, and it's just going to reconfirm your faith that you are making a difference.
That's Regina Talbert. She shared her story with our Hear Here project at the Golden Gate branch of the Oakland Public Library. Her story was produced by the award-winning Audrey Dilling. As you just heard, Regina Talbert has seen a lot over the 30 years she's worked at Highland Hospital, and will stay at Highland for our next story from San Francisco StoryCorps. For the next few weeks, we'll be airing a series of interviews conducted by the StoryCorps team at Highland. Today, Bruce Bauer has a chat with Laura Sargent. Bauer has been a volunteer with the Alameda Health System Foundation for 20 years, fundraising for the hospital. He told Sargent, who was a foundation staff member, about his first visit to Highland when he was 5 years old, and how his vending machine business started his relationship with the hospital.
And my first memories of coming in was the doctors and the nurses. They were all dressed in white uniforms, white hats, white nylon stockings. It was like walking out of into a different world. Of course, I was, you know, 5, 6 years old at that point in time, and it made a big impression on me.
So you own West Coast Vending and Food Service. When did you first start working in Alameda Health System, like in Highland and all the hospitals?
Yeah, we've been doing the vending service here for since 1981. A lot of changes were over the time. The vending wasn't as big back in those days as it is now, but of course the hospital's expanded, gotten bigger. There's more patients coming here. You know, and I've never refused anybody that asked for a candy bar or a sandwich. I've always given them to them, you know, when I was servicing the machines. And then I would deliver the toys to the ER after I filled the machines on the weekends here.
And the toys, each child would be allowed to bring a toy home?
Yeah, if he was in some kind of trauma or he was a good patient, they were allowed to go in the toy chest and take one toy and take it home with them, pick out what they wanted. And that toy chest used to get empty. I used to bring like 50, 75 toys in there, and I'd fill it once or twice a month.
How does the work of Alameda Health System and the Foundation tie into your own values?
You know, over the years, healthcare is important. You know, family, job, healthcare. Those three things you really need a lot in combination to have a good life. You know, I had, when Courtney was five, we had a problem with her. She came down with leukemia, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and that was the hardest part of my life. But she's well now. She's really good. 3 years of chemo was a lot to go through, and to keep the family together and everything was really hard. You know, you don't think of healthcare, but when you need it, something like that happens to you, you got to have it. I've seen so many families be destroyed because they didn't have healthcare. Over the years, you know, I've seen the patients come and go here and people here, and I know the hospital treats their patients where they can don't have the funds to pay for it or not. And that's what's one of the biggest impacts that hit me, because I know someone could be here and they could take care of their health needs if they needed it, and if they couldn't pay for it. You know, I can't say more about this hospital. It's an amazing place. And I think people that come here probably get the best health care ever. You know, I just wish they'd bring back all the white uniforms, because that's what impressed me most when I was 4 or 5 years old.
That's Bruce Bauer speaking with Laura Sargent at Highland Hospital. Their interview was brought to us by San Francisco StoryCorps and facilitated by Olivia Cueva. It was edited by KALW's Ryan Miller. To hear more stories like this, go to KALW.org and click on StoryCorps. That's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Jen Sheehan, Leela Day, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Nina Gensler-Debs, Rebecca Burungi, Liz Mack, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, Seth Samuel, and Rachel Wong. Today's show was engineered by Mr. Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to you, KALW is homegrown, locally sourced, independent, commercial-free, listener-supported public radio. The Temescal, or Ritual Sweat Lodge, was prominent in this part of the world prior to European colonization. Temescals were used for spiritual and physical renewal. And that is why the Temescal String Quartet of Oakland chose the name. Playing chamber music together has those same benefits for them. The Temescal String Quartet will have a midday concert tomorrow at Old St. Mary's Cathedral in San Francisco starting at 12:30 p.m. For more information or to hear more local music, visit our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.